I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, a show for curious cooks and eaters. All right, so I get to fanboy a little bit right now because one of my favorite things in the world is a podcast called Still Processing. It's hosted by Jenna Wortham and Wesley Morris, and it's like going out to dinner with two of your smartest friends on a night where you feel like you might just be able to figure out what's going on in the world before dessert hits. You know, they talk about anything. They'll talk about technology, movies, tennis, what it's like being black and visiting the African-American Museum of the Smithsonian for the first time, or they'll just argue about what hot jam is going to be the song of the summer. But no matter what they talk about, I always want to hear what they have to say about culture and what it says about us. Now, I'm obviously fascinated by what our food says about us, so I'm thrilled to have them join me. So Jenna, Wesley, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having us. It's a pleasure.
Happy to be here.
You two are absolutely two of my favorite thinkers about pop culture and technology and what they all mean. So I'm super excited to talk to you about what I've come to realize is sort of the operating assumption of my career. So I hope you agree with me.
Okay.
But that is this. I think that for the past 10 years or so, food has been moving like closer and closer to the center of our pop culture. Mm-hmm. And what I mean is like, in the way that we used to care only about movies or music, we now care about food in a similar mm-hmm. kind of way. Mm-hmm. And the reason why I say the whole, especially in the last 10 years thing, is that I think about, okay, when Twitter started getting big, I remember everyone bust on it and it was like sort of embarrassing. And the whole thing was like, God, like anyone really wants to know what you have for breakfast. Like that was the line, right? That was the line when you wanted to cut down someone and be like, I joined Twitter. But now you look, fast forward however many years later, and you, like Instagram has like what, almost three times as many users as Twitter. And I swear like half of Instagram is literally mm-hmm. what you have for breakfast. So did something happen? Like did our attitudes change? Like what happened? And am I right? You can tell me if I'm wrong.
No, I think you're right. I would agree with that.
Yeah.
Food is a big part of how we express what we're into and who we are and what, I don't know, like I was going to say what trends we're paying attention to, but there's so much signaling we do with our diet, mm-hmm. where you go, how cultured you are, what your food experiences are.
Yes. I also think that it's one of the last experiences that can't be changed. I think that one of the things about food is that it's personal, it's communal, it's visual. Restaurants are now, I've been reading, thinking about how to maximize their Instagrammability.
Sure.
And how to serve and plate so that the food is Instagrammable and how to
package. And the lighting works.
Yeah. So, I mean, you're 100% right. I mean, I could see this happening at the beginning too, where I was one of those people who was interested in taking pictures of, I think my Instagram avatar still is a fish that I ate at Eataly in like 2010. It was a branzino and it was really good. But then I stopped taking pictures of food.
Why?
It kind of made me feel sad.
Well, it's a funny experience to be in a restaurant and watch someone be really obsessed with taking a picture of their food, of their plate, of their meal. Mm-hmm. But I don't know it's sad necessarily. It's just it's curious.
It is a different way of blessing your food though, right? Like you're not like thanking God. You're like you're offering your meal to Instagram instead.
Yeah. It's thank you, Kevin Systrom.
Right. It's like a weird development.
It feels odd because it's almost I try not to harbor any judgment about anyone, you know, what they do with their food. Like, you do what you do food, but like, mm-hmm. what brings you most mm-hmm. pleasure and sustenance from it, hopefully. But I do also have a little bit of a pang when I see that. And part of it is maybe because even, like, at home, like, I get pretty live if I'm, like, dinner's ready and my wife is, like, you know, playing Word with friends or whatever. I'm like, babe, let's eat. It's hot. Babe, come on over. And she'd be like, all right, I'll be there in a minute. I'm like, ooh. Like I'm watching the food die. Like something about its spirit is lifting with the steam, you know?
That's
but
real.
Again, I don't know. I'm not eating that food. You are. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But for me, I also look at that and I wonder, you're seeing someone in the moment where they should be having this intimate bodily experience and they're mitigating it, right? Mm-hmm. They're like putting this thing in between themselves mm-hmm. and this thing that should be feeding their bodies. And maybe there's just an instinct there that feels like, oh, that's weird.
Well, maybe it's a reaction to the notion when we sit down to break bread, it's a moment of communal sharing. Mm-hmm. It's a moment of just, you know, almost like a meditative experience of just the act of eating and chewing and swallowing, or at least that's how we maybe, you know, idolize it. But whenever I see someone taking a picture of their food, I'm really happy because I get a lot of my, this is really sad to say out loud, but I get a lot of my nutrition information via like Instagram. So I love seeing how other people are doing healthy living. I get really into like hashtag Whole30 because I'm like, what is that? Or, you know,
what is hashtag Whole30?
It's a style of eating about, you know, it's basically prioritizing, you know, unprocessed foods, lean proteins, fresh fruit, et cetera, and just seeing how people are organizing and doing meal prep and meal planning, which are things I didn't grow up with. I mean, I grew up in a very Southern household, shrimp and grits, you know, biscuits and gravy, stuff that, you know, my figure now that I'm in my 30s, like that's not going to work for my day to day. You know, I can't bring a tin of, you know, country fried steak in for lunch as much as I'd like to. I can't. So I need information about how to live and how to be. And I like seeing how other people, you know, construct and organize their week of eating at the office.
Mm-hmm. So I have no data on this with the picture taking, but I wonder if it's the same thing. And I'm sure there's data that can be applied to this hypothesis that I'm about to offer you to, which is that I think it's the same dopamine rush that people have when they're willing to risk their whole life to be on the phone and almost die. Like that moment where like you just, you're dragging three roller bags behind you and you've got your phone in one hand and you're like in the subway station.
Right.
And you're like, I don't know, a half an inch from falling onto the tracks, but you don't care because you're like, you're on your phone and you're so high on the phone and the experience of communicating whatever it is that you are or experiencing whatever it is that's on the phone that tune all out. Your other pleasure sensors are sort of aimed at this one device.
Yeah.
And so I think you're actually like momentarily not only shutting off it's not shutting off your brain, but I think you're completely estranged from your gustatory senses and your olfactory senses in that moment.
Yeah, you're just feeding a different instinct, feeding another pleasure center.
Right.
And actually it's interesting what Jenna's saying too. It's like, oh, on one hand, if you look at that moment of the person taking the picture or whatever, there's that kind of vibe of, well, are they removing themselves from that experience? You're thinking about what they're losing, potentially. But then the other thing is like, oh no, you have this incredible community that you can feel, or you know that you're part of this larger system now, this larger organism that's creating inspiring moments for other people, and you're taking inspiration from it sometimes. And it feels like, it's almost like what you said earlier before, Wesley, I knew it was a joke, but like you are sort of offering your meal to Instagram.
But I also think there are other reasons beyond social sharing that people take pictures of their food. Because I think, especially now that smartphones have gotten so much better at aggregating and organizing information, I have food diaries on my phone where I just want to see how I was eating seasonally. Or I wanted to share them with one friend. Or, you know, I tend to go through periods of time where I'm like fermenting a bunch in my house, or like I'm only eating fermented foods, or I'm only eating like things that are liquid. And it becomes like a running joke. So it's like a way for me to be in conversation with one person who's like, look at my smoothie again. You know, it's like I'm taking a picture, but it's not necessarily for anyone other than myself or one other person, which I think is also an important part of food being social but not publicly shared.
I have a friend named Danny Chow who lives in LA, and Danny Chow eats everything like a lot of really good LA people do. He eats everything, and everything he eats he puts on Instagram. It's Chau if you want to see his meals. He doesn't offer a great deal of commentary, but there's so much pleasure in just the way he shoots these images. And the food looks great. And sometimes it's at a restaurant that I'm familiar with. Most of the time, as a person who only visits Los Angeles, it's someplace I've never even heard of before. And it's the gamut of every single type of eating experience you could possibly have. And that, to me, actually is a form of meal for me. I can't eat I can't eat anything that he's actually taking a picture of, but it does satisfy some basic food-oriented curiosity that I have about other people's dining out habits as well.
Well, especially now, I mean, you know, Instagram is, just going back to Instagram, it's evolving as a tool, and they now have the ability, you now have the ability to collect images and make collections. You can bookmark things. So I had a couple of friends who were all in Japan recently and eating all over Tokyo, eating just all over the country. And I book, I mean, I don't have plans to go to Japan, but when I do, I'm going to go in that collection and be like, where'd they eat? Because I want to eat there. So there is
and
a way in which
that experience, it, absolutely, that imagination. There,
absolutely. Right? I also kind of really love, this is so embarrassing to admit. I feel like I'm about to admit that I had McDonald's for breakfast or something, but I just.
The hash browns are legit.
I mean, look, yes. No shade. But I kind of really like Instagram food crazes, like when people go to Black Tap and want the giant sundaes on top of the brownies with the M&Ms and a 3-pound gummy bear at the top that you can't eat. You just go and spend $60 so you can take the picture. And, you know, and people want the cronuts and then the cronut bacon, you know, bacon, egg and cheese sandwich. And then all that stuff to me, I know it's so gimmicky and I know it's so silly, but it actually brings me a lot of pleasure just because I feel like it feels like a weird new, obviously very capitalistic, but a weird new brand of food culinary creativity that I'm used to only seeing on reality food competitions or it feels just like a thing that exists alongside of all these other categories of how we eat now. But it just brings me a lot of joy to look at it.
Who doesn't want to feel like there actually is a Willy Wonka somewhere, right?
Yes! Oh my God, that's exactly it. That's exactly what it is.
Well, thank you guys so much for coming in today.
No, it was a pleasure. Thanks for having us.
It's great to talk with y'all.
It's an honor to be on the show.
Oh, come on. Stop it.
It's true.
It's really fun.
Jenna Wortham and Wesley Morris are the hosts of the podcast Still Processing. Now, obviously food has always been a big part of every culture, but after I talked with Jenna and Wesley, they really got my head going on how food isn't just part of our identities, but how much we wear that on our sleeves. So we wanted to do a show where we look at a bunch of different ways people do that. So today we'll talk with a chef who abandoned the food he grew up with to make a career in fine dining, only to come back around and devote himself to his mom's cooking. We'll hear about a kitchen gadget with the world's most cultish fans when America's Test Kitchen gives us their take on the Instant Pot. We'll talk with a psychologist on how shopping for good food can make us bad people. And we'll find out how a bunch of hippies who just wanted to stick it to the man ended up changing American bread. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM American Public Media. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters. You know, so I guess we're living in a time where nothing's surprising anymore, but I gotta say, I'm still pretty astounded by how much people go bananas for the Instant Pot. I mean, it's a slow cooker that's also a pressure cooker, and apparently that combination is so mystical that it has, in the words of one newspaper, spawned a religion. People are crazy for this thing. Is it really that good? America's Test Kitchen actually tested the Instant Pot along with a bunch of other multi-cookers, and our managing producer, Sally Swift, talked with ATK's Hannah Crowley.
Hey, Hannah, great to have you here.
Hi, thank you so much.
I want to talk to you today about a new culinary cult. It's called the multi-cooker. What do you have to say about that?
Well, I think the real cult members would consider themselves Instant Pot owners.
Uh-huh.
So Instant Pot is a type of multi-cooker. And I think it's called genericization when something is so huge in their field that they take it over, like Kleenex and tissues and Band-Aid and bandages. Instant Pot is that in the multi-cooker field. They are crazy popular. Their Facebook group has 1.1 million members in it right now.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, I have recently been cooking with one, and I actually have some issues with it. And I know that you guys evaluated multi-cookers. So I want to back up and not talk specific brands. What should we be looking for when we're looking to buy a multi-cooker?
Well, I think you're not alone in being confused because the number of buttons on these things is downright insane. I think we've counted like 20 buttons on these, and they're random food groups. Like they'll just say chicken or beef or yogurt. And it's like, well, is it bone-in chicken or is it boneless, skinless chicken breast? Because those two things cook really differently.
And are you pressure cooking or are you slow cooking?
Yeah. And like sometimes when it's on, it's just like a teeny little red dot. It's like, what's going on inside this pot? So one of the things to look for is a nice, clean, simple control panel that tells you what it's doing.
Okay, that makes total sense to me. And what about size? Is there a specific size you like?
So we really like 8 quarts. I think 6 quarts is the most popular size, but we like to go one size bigger because it gets you a little more room, like maneuvering inside the pot if you've got a whole chicken in there. And it also gets you a broader cooking surface on the bottom of the pot.
Oh, yeah.
We love that you can sear in these because that means you don't have to dirty an extra dish. You can do the first step of your stew mm-hmm. and then build the stew right in the pot.
And what about, I had a moment with my Instapot where the seal wasn't attached suddenly.
Yes, that happened to me quite a few times during testing, too. You'll notice a little silicone gasket running around the inside of the lid. 99% of the time, if your pot isn't sealing, that has slipped out of place and is actually disrupting the seal. So look at the silicone gasket and make sure it's tucked up in place before you close your lid.
Okay, now you evaluated Instapot versus some other cookers. Tell us how that fell out for you.
So I don't want any hate mail, but we actually, the Instant Pot did not win our testing.
Shocking.
Yes. So these things, they're trying to replace a bunch of different appliances. Pressure cookers, slow cookers, rice cookers, and everything we tested was really good at pressure cooking. But the Instant Pot isn't quite as good at slow cooking than other models.
Huh, that's interesting.
Yeah, so we worked with Dr. Robert Hurd from Carnegie Mellon University, and he helped us calculate what's called power availability by volume. Basically, it's the amount of heat that's getting to the food from these pots. And the Instant Pot just had a little bit less. So it can slow cook most things just fine, but if you're getting into some really thick, dense, large volume things like beef stew or Chinese spare ribs, mm-hmm. it's going to take forever, or it might not even be able to finish at all.
So what was your top pick in these multi-cookers?
We liked a brand called the Fagor Lux LCD. It's about $200. It pressure cooks really well. It slow cooks pretty well, too. And it had a couple extra features that really helped it rise to the top. It has an alert. If your lid doesn't seal correctly, it will tell you.
I needed that.
Yeah. Well, it's a really bummer when it happens because if it doesn't have an alert, it just tries to build pressure. It tries and tries and tries. And while it's trying to build pressure, it's actually cooking the food.
Right.
And so it usually takes about 20 minutes to come to pressure. So it's trying that whole time. And it takes a while sometimes to realize that it's not working. So the whole time it's been cooking, you really cook your food like 1.5 times. So we love that it has an alert that tells you when the lid isn't sealed. We also liked it. A super clean LCD interface. It tells you exactly what it's doing, when it's doing it. We also liked that you can lock its screen. Like this, a lot of the other ones, if you bump it or nudge it, you can actually cancel or start over or change your cook setting. So we like that you can lock it.
Can you use any slow cooker recipe in all of these pots?
We found, so we're developing a book right now. It's called Multi-Cooker Perfection. It's out this April. We found pressure cooking recipes really easy to adapt. Slow cooking recipes really, really hard.
Oh, that's so opposite of what I would think.
Yeah, I know. The problems were twofold. And they're on both ends of the spectrum. First, these heat up really differently than a traditional slow cooker. A traditional slow cooker slowly, gently comes up to temperature, mm-hmm. whereas these just skyrocket. Mm-hmm. So for delicate things like chicken breasts, you're probably going to want to check them sooner than you would in a traditional slow cooker. And on the other end of the spectrum, this is where the Instant Pot problem really, really came in, is really thick, dense things, they might not finish if you don't have a recipe that's really perfectly calibrated for a multi-cooker.
Huh. Now, I know that you have been cooking a million things in these multi-cookers. Is there a recipe that really knocked your socks off?
I bet you'd never guess this in a million years, but we did mussels in them.
Mussels?
Yeah, and you're wondering why bother, like why speed up mussels? They already don't take that long. They're pretty easy to do. But we found when you're cooking under pressure in these, the lid is really tightly closed, which creates a really moist environment inside. And we found with mussels, first of all, we cooked them for 1 minute under pressure. And we found they turned out amazingly evenly cooked and tender and plump and sweet. Unlike sometimes when you cook them on the stove, you know, some pop early, some pop late, they end up kind of overcooked and uneven. In the multi-cooker, they were perfect every time.
Wow, that sounds great. Hannah, thanks for the update.
Thank you so much.
Hannah Crowley is the deputy editor of Tastings and Testings at America's Test Kitchen. And if you want to take your multi-cooker for a spin, you can check out ATK's recipe for multi-pot mussels with white wine and garlic. That's at splendidtable.org. And if you make it, send us a photo of it. Tag us on Instagram, because you're going to gram it anyway, right? So between Instagram and Instant Pots, We've been talking this hour about how, when people show off their food, they're showing off some part of themselves that they want you to see. You know, we're always a little bit performing, right? We're living our values out loud, you know what I mean? And back in the 60s and 70s, from the Summer of Love to the end of the Vietnam War, the hippies did exactly that. The hippies were the poster children of wearing your values on your sleeve, and almost everything they did was to show us how to break away from the mainstream. The way they dressed, the way they talked, the way they smelled, and of course, the way they ate. And while you might still know a couple of deadheads, I'm almost sure you're still eating food that the hippies popularized. Granola, tofu, soy milk, and maybe even the toast you had this morning. Our contributor Joe Yonan, food and dining editor of the Washington Post, talked with Jonathan Kaufman, author of a book called Hippie Food, about America's reintroduction to brown bread.
Hey, Jonathan. Great to have you.
Hey, Joe. Great to be here.
So, Jonathan, why did hippies, or the long hairs, the revolutionaries that you write about, why did they end up taking up whole wheat bread?
Well, the counterculture natural food movement was really oriented around the idea that we needed to avoid industrialized food. So that meant any food that was grown with pesticides and herbicides and fertilizers and that was made with all kinds of additives and flavorings. So the way they wanted to do that was by going back to, you know, a simpler way of cooking and eating whole foods as much as possible so they could kind of escape the industrialized food supply. And because bread was so central to the American diet, they figured that, you know, changing the bread they ate and learning how to bake it was taking control over their health.
So where did the hippies start baking this brown bread?
Well, one of my favorite stories about the early period, sort of the late 1960s, was in San Francisco in the Haight-Ashbury during the Summer of Love. There was this group of hippies who called themselves the Diggers, and they were the radical philosophers of the hippie scene. And they used guerrilla theater and these big street parties to shock people into thinking about the world in some new ways. And they were also really concerned about all of the teenagers who were like taking a bus to San Francisco and showing up with no money and no good sense of, you know, how to live once they arrived in, you know, among the flower children. And so they began dishing out stew in Golden Gate Park, and anybody who could bring a spoon and a bowl could eat for free. And this engineer from Palo Alto named Walt Reynolds heard about this, and he decided they needed to have bread as well. So he drove up to this church in the Haight-Ashbury. He brought 100-pound sacks of flour and a ton of coffee cans and taught them how to make these cylindrical loaves. And they were so successful that they began baking like hundreds of loaves of bread to give away every week. And then they gave that recipe out to everybody.
So it sounds like this recipe was really part of the resistance, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you have to remember that for most of the baby boomers, bread was fluffy, snow white, chemically enhanced Wonder Bread. So, you know, there was this rising consciousness of all of the food additives and preservatives that were needed to make white bread, and they started calling it plastic bread.
So back to those cans of brown bread, and how do I ask you this, Jonathan? Was this good bread? Did it taste good?
What I heard from the people who were baking it was that it really depended on the baker.
Okay. But that,
some of the early experiments with whole wheat baking were not great. The macrobiotic diet, which was also popular in this early, you know, hippie era, didn't believe in yeasted breads. They felt like they were dangerously unhealthy. And so you would have macrobiotic kids baking these 1-pound bricks of dough and then slicing them into these very thin slices. And that was the only way you could eat them.
So how did it get better? I'm assuming it must have gotten better. And how did they learn to bake whole wheat bread that was more interesting?
I think, like much of the diet, I think practice really, really helped. I mean, I think so many people had this idea of what hippie food was based on those early experiments. I think the most influential teacher was Edward Espy Brown, who was a monk at the San Francisco Zen Center. And he was the head cook at the Tassajara Zen Monastery in Northern California. And he had learned how to make this really good brown bread from a couple of folks, you know, a couple of older folks. And he just was making it and experimenting it, and it was so good that he decided that he should really write a book that would teach people not just sort of a recipe, but like how bread should look and feel when you're kneading it, how it should smell. And the recipe he came up with was so reliable and so tasty that the Tassajara bread book, which came out in 1971, really took off. It became a bestseller.
It somehow isn't surprising that it all comes back to a monk when it comes to bread breaking.
Oh, I mean, he was all about, you know, the sense of present, being present with the dough as you're making it. It's very romantic as well as practical.
So is this where community bakeries got their start?
It was. A lot of the counterculture kids weren't just, you know, interested in improving their health, but really creating a new economy that was outside of you know, large-scale capitalism and the industrialized food supply. So in the mid-1970s, a number of collectively run bakeries formed, and many of them based their core recipe on Edward Brown's Tassajara bread recipe.
So Jonathan, you write a lot about how the hippies affected what we eat today. Do you think that we can thank them for our current obsession with whole grains?
I think we really can. When you look at early nutritionists and what they were saying about whole wheat bread and brown rice, is they were really poo-pooing it. They felt like there was no real nutritional advantage to eating whole wheat bread over regular bread as long as you ate a balanced diet. But in the late 1970s, scientists and nutritionists began discovering the beneficial effects of fiber. And all of a sudden, this kooky diet started making a lot more sense. And so now even the USDA recommends that we eat half of our grains as whole grains. But even more recently, there's this interest in baking circles in heirloom grains and ancient grains. And there's a whole new crop of bakers who are inspired by Chad Robertson at Tartine Bakery, who are baking these airy, crusty, beautiful sourdough loaves. And this is some of the best bread that you can find in the United States.
Well, I know I'm not the only one that then is very thankful for the hippies. Thank you so much for coming in to talk to us about it, Jonathan.
Thanks for having me.
Jonathan Kaufman is author of Hippie Food: How Back to the Landers, Longhairs, and Revolutionaries Changed the Way We Eat. Joe Yonan is the author of America, the Great Cookbook. And if that conversation got you excited for some whole wheat bread, you should head to our website, splendidtable.org, for a terrific recipe from Chad Robertson of Tartine. And he really is one of the great bakers of the world. Anyway, we have his recipe for whole wheat bread on splendidtable.org. Chef James Siabut's family came to America from a Lao refugee camp in Thailand. It was 1981, and they didn't know a single person. They were settled on 25th Street in Oakland, California, in a neighborhood called the Laotian Ghetto, and James grew up there at cookouts with the neighbors who became his aunties and uncles. And he grew up in the Thai restaurant his mother opened and ran for most of his life. He worked in that restaurant after school, every weekend, every summer break. And he was a seasoned restaurant professional by the time he graduated high school, but it was turning on the TV one morning that actually made him want to be a chef. So James, can you tell us about what you saw on TV that day?
I saw professionals. I saw a whole new level of cookery than what I was living in mom and pop's place. What I saw on TV was like, wow, this magnificent chef with starch whites, a toque, immaculate kitchen, copper pans, and making beautiful, meticulous food. And that's when got the bug bite. It's like, wow, I need to do that. And, you know, parents, especially being first-generation Asian American, you know, we came here to live the American dream. I told my mom, like, I want to cook for a living. She thought I was nuts, you know. She's like, okay, you want to cook, but I'll need to tell you, you're going to be very, very poor. And she's like, it's beyond financially, you know, socially, emotionally, and she didn't want me to do it.
So it's funny, so her world of professional cooking was just drudgery, just hard work and trying to make it by. And what you were trying to say to her was, no, there's more to it than that.
Yeah.
There's a great moment in the book where you talk about using like a high power blender for the first time and making a puree versus thinking about pounding a mortar and pestle. Can you tell us about that?
Oh yeah, it's just like a much different, efficient approach. You know, fine dining, everything's more refined, everything's smoother, everything's passed through a chinois. We're making stock, and I was never taught at least my mom, we never skimmed it. And once I got into culinary school, like, you know, we constantly skim our stock, strain it, pass it through cheesecloth, get as clear as you want. But now looking back, I'm like asking myself, why are we not skimming the stock, like making, you know, pho or kabun? It's like that impurities, it's protein, it's flavor. You know, why do we want to skim that away? You know, so there's two sides of the argument. Mm. And I'm kind of like stuck in the middle. So it's like kind of like situational.
Yeah. And it's situational in a really interesting way because you, I mean, you truly are now a star in the world of fine dining. Your restaurant, Komi, is a 2-Michelin-star restaurant. So by that standard, it's literally one of the best restaurants in the world where you serve extremely refined, creative, high-end food. But then mm-hmm. after a few years of having the restaurant and having, you know, accolades and press, there's another moment in your life that you talk about in the book where you're visiting your mom in her restaurant. And it'd been years where business was getting sort of bad for her and she's tired and she wants to give up but can't let go. Can you remember that moment?
Oh, you know, very vividly. I remember, like, you know, what the weather was like. Walking to the kitchen, you know, and I haven't seen my mother for a while, even though the restaurant is so close. I was just so focused on Komi. I went to visit one, just kind of check in. Actually, I was kind of hungry. And I was walking in. I was like, wow, it's my mom kind of looked lost and fatigued. And she wasn't in a happy place. And the state of the restaurant was in a happy place. You know, a lot of neglected maintenance. And, you know, be mindful, this is like 2009, 2010. So, you know, the economy was still not in the best shape. And I can help my mom see my mom live this way. And she always talked about going to go back home. I just want to live in the countryside and raise water buffaloes and, you know, be in the rice fields and be with her siblings. And I was like, you know, that's it. It's like, that's what you're going to do. Just drop everything. I'll buy you a one-way plane ticket back and don't worry about the rest, you know. And then I got, now I'm a leaseholder now of this restaurant I grew up in. It's like, yeah, you know, I could easily do a light version of Komi, and open a bistro and serve duck confit and steak frites, and it'll be Komi casual in a way. But it's like, that place is just so sentimental for me. And it kind of hit me a shock where, man, I can't come over for like these meals anymore. Mm. When I want to eat some jeo pedak or, you know, kabun, that's like, and it's a shame. I've seen it made before. But I was never involved in the entire process of making these dishes. And it's kind of a shame, like, what got me in the love of cooking, I kind of turned my back on. Right. And I was like, yeah, it's a damn shame. It's like, you know, I kind of left some things kind of unsettled. Yeah, so yeah. Kind of like going back and, you know, reconciling my past. And, yeah, I kind of remember and respect, like, why I got into cooking in the first place.
Yeah. So now you have these two sides. You have the fine dining, Komi, you know, largely European-derived technique and exceeding at that. And now you have this other restaurant, Hawker Fare, right, which is about cooking the Laotian food that you had to find. You know, it was in your memory, but you had to, like, actually learn how to make. So, you know, in this episode, we've been talking a lot about how people feel that their food says something about them. So how do you think of yourself now as a cook and as a person versus when you felt like, you know, the world that mattered was fine dining?
Now I feel well more rounded. I feel more as a overall rounded cook on a personal level, on a soulful level, that now like my two worlds are finally colliding. Now I actually, they kind of work in tandem. In no means like I fused the two cuisines. It just affects the way I cook and look at food. It makes me understand what my role as a chef is to make food delicious. And now I have this point of reference of, like, when I make a dish at Komi, conceptualizing a dish at Komi, like, very elaborate process. And at the end of the day, we taste the dish. And the question I ask myself now is, like, yeah, it's cool, it's pretty, it looks nice. But is it satisfying? Is it delicious? Is it as craving as, you know, the dom kim stew that my mom makes? Does it gives me that same satisfaction? So that, I think that helps me become a better fine dining cook, if anything.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, and the tricky part, like, it doesn't work reverse. When I started cooking Lao, no, seriously, when I started cooking Lao food, I was being too technical and systematic and not letting my instincts tell me. I was too like technique driven because I was been fine dining for so long. I became like a jarhead somewhat. So, you know, in cooking Lao food and like rustic food in general, you have to use your instincts. You have to like trust your instincts, make sure you're calibrated. You know, and that's how the way, you know, a lot of moms cook. You know, a handful of this, a pinch of that, throw this in. It's delicious, you know. She's not overthinking it. And that's the beauty of it.
Yeah. Thank you, Chef.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a fun discussion.
James Siaboot's book is Hawker Fare, Stories and Recipes from a Refugee Chef's Thai, Isan, and Lao Roots. Find his recipe for shredded chicken salad with herbs, fish sauce, and lime, also called yum gai, at splendidtable.org. And coming up...
People who bring their own shopping bags to the grocery store, when they do it out of their own free wills, two things tend to happen. One is that you buy more organic produce and products, which isn't all that surprising. The part that's surprising, however, is that people who bring their own bags often tend to put more treats into their cart for themselves than people who don't.
We are incredibly mysterious creatures. Stick around. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is Francis Lam, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters. All right, and now we get to talk to each other. You can always call us 1-800-537-5252, or we're on Facebook or Twitter, or email us, contact@splendidtable.org. Hi, so we have Kathy on the line. Hey, Kathy, how are you?
I'm very good. Thank you very much.
All right, where are you calling
from? It's lovely to speak to you.
Oh, the same. Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Mexico.
Oh, wow. Where?
San Miguel de Allende. It's about the geographic center of the country.
Oh, wow.
It's just beautiful. You know, it's a World Heritage Site.
I know. I'm sure it's gorgeous.
It is.
So what would you like to talk about, Kathy?
You know, I'm confused about sambal. I want to know, is that a generic term, or is it a particular brand, or is it like a term like salsa? When a recipe calls for sambal, what do I use?
Oh, okay. Sambal. Okay. So sambal, as I understand it, in Malaysia, certainly, and probably Indonesia, and maybe other parts of Southeast Asia too, it can refer to lots of different things. Lots of different things are sambals. Typically a pounded or mashed together mix of chilies and aromatics and, you know, just really, really gorgeous stuff, and sometimes cooked and sometimes raw, I think. But typically when you hear people in, you know, North America talk about sambal, or if it's in a recipe, I think they're almost always referring to a product that's basically a chili paste, almost like but a pretty loose chili paste that you would use almost like a hot sauce. If you like sriracha, it's
with garlic.
Yeah, usually with garlic, and it's, you know, a little bit tart. Usually I think the chilies are fermented, and it's a little bit salty, a little bit of funk, but not a whole lot. And you're going to have a nice little bite from chilies and a little bit of acid. It's really, really delicious stuff. The brand I see most is called Sambal Olek. O-E-L-E-K.
Yes.
Yeah, it usually comes in a little plastic jar.
Yes, I actually have some.
Oh, perfect, yeah. So that stuff is great. And I think when most people refer to sambal, that's what they're talking about. It's like this chili paste, hot sauce kind of condiment. It's similar to sriracha, if you like sriracha, but without the sweetness, and it's not pureed. It's a little chunkier. It has a little more texture to it.
Okay, so is sambal actually a generic term, or is it a particular product?
So I think here, the way we use it, we're usually referring to that product that you have in the jar with the green cap,
okay,
like a rooster in the label. But yeah, in Southeast Asia, in Malaysia, it's more of a generic term.
Okay. Hmm. Oh, well, that clears up a lot.
Well, right on.
Thank
but it's delicious
very
stuff,
much.
So I'm glad you have it on hand to, you know, play with.
Thank you very much, and thanks for taking my question.
Oh, my pleasure.
And good luck with the program.
Oh, thank you.
Goodbye.
Take care. Bye. And we have an email from Martha. And she's asking, could we talk about the difference in salts? Kosher, fleur de sel, Himalayan, sea salt, etc. Can they be used whenever a recipe calls for salt. Okay, so there are lots of people who are salt experts, and you know what really matters to them is like the mineral composition of the salts and what other minerals are involved in those salts. It depends on the water they're from or where the salt comes from, and they have a specific flavor and all that stuff. And I think that stuff is super interesting. I'm not an expert, and I think in general, that's kind of not what the question is. Because it sounds like if the question is, can all these salts be used when you call for salt in food? I think the bigger thing is, what does the salt look like? And by that, I don't mean color. I mean the crystals, the shape. So if you take some table salt, like regular old, you know, table salt, pour it into a little teaspoon and look at it. It'll be tiny, tiny, tiny. The crystals are super tiny. And if you take something like a kosher salt, pour that in a teaspoon, and there'll be like bigger flakes. Or a fleur de sel will certainly be really chunky and kind of clumpy. And there's a Malden salt that's beautiful, flat crystals. And basically what I'm getting at is those different shapes will sit differently in the spoon, which means there will be more or less air in the spoon, which means 1 teaspoon of table salt is actually a different amount of salt than a teaspoon of kosher salt or a teaspoon of fleur de sel or something else. So if you're using them for cooking and you're following a recipe and you're using a volume measurement, that's where you have to be really careful, and you have to find out what kind of salt they're actually calling for in the recipe. Because if they're calling for kosher salt, which is much lighter, and there's less, literally less salt in a teaspoon, and you use table salt, then you're going to end up with a lot saltier food than the recipe intended. You know what I mean? So that's really the big difference for day-to-day cooking purposes. It's really that salt shape. And a lot of chefs love kosher salt, and a lot of chefs in particular love a brand called Diamond Crystal Kosher Salt, because I think they're just used to using it, and they're used to knowing how much salt one pinch actually gets you. You know, like, they know how much saltier it gets with each pinch. So it's really just a matter of muscle memory and what you're comfortable with. And certainly the really big flaky salts, the big crunchy salts too, the special thing with those is they have that crunch. And finishing dishes with those is special because it adds that extra bit of texture and a little pop of saltiness as you're eating, as opposed to an overall seasoning effect. So I hope that helps. And always, always, always call us. Leave us a voicemail. 1-800-537-5252. All right, so by this time in this episode, I'm pretty sure you get it. How we eat says a lot about us, or at least how we say we eat says a lot about us. But Rachel Herz is here to kind of mess with that idea a little bit, because she's a psychologist and a neuroscientist, and she's written a book called Why You Eat What You Eat. It's a fascinating read about the psychology of our food choices, and a lot of what she's found is probably not what most people would expect. So Dr. Herz, can you tell us about the study about people who brought their own bags while shopping at the grocery store?
So people who bring their own shopping bags to the grocery store, when they do it out of their own free will, so it's different if you have to shop in places where they penalize you for not bringing your own bags. But if you're still somewhere in the country where you're doing something virtuous by bringing your own bag and being conscientious about the environment, then two things tend to happen. One is that you buy more organic produce and products, which isn't all that surprising, considering that if you're being environmentally conscientious, you're probably also, you know, concerned with eating organic food. The Sure. part that's surprising, however, is that people who bring their own bags often tend to put more treats into their cart for themselves than people who don't. And this is because we have this incredible balancing act within ourselves of matching our virtues with our vices. And so bringing that reusable bag, which is good for Mother Nature, makes you feel like you deserve a little pat on the back. And in a grocery store, that comes in the form of something tasty that you'd like to eat. Now, this does happen only when people are shopping for themselves. So if you're like shopping for the family for the week and so forth, you're less inclined to put extra treats in your cart. But if you're a singleton shopping with your reusable bag, you do end up buying yourself more goodies. Another one that had to do with grocery shopping was a study that had radio frequency tags on the grocery carts themselves, and found that after people had shopped in the produce section and bought the grapefruit and the kale into their basket, the next area of the store they went to was either the alcohol or the ice cream departments. So again, balancing good with bad.
Really? So just like people just naturally like, hey, I bought kale. Now I'm going to go get some booze. Like, exactly. That's the next thing you shop for?
Well, you know, I think
obviously this is on a semi-unconscious level, I think, for most people, but I know people who sort of set themselves up with little goals, like if I stay at my desk working on this grant or whatever it is I'm working on for another hour, I'll let myself have a cookie. Or maybe I'll say, you know, if I go to the gym today, then I'm going to be like drinking beer tonight, you know, whatever the case is. And the problem is often these things in caloric terms, in that sense of the balance, don't even themselves out. And I think people really have a misconception when it comes to exercise, where definitely we burn more calories exercising than sitting still. But the amount of calories we're burning for various activities is not as much as we think. Often, well, we're making up for it with a handful of extra cookies or a muffin.
Yeah. But okay, you have another story in the book that I'm fascinated by. And it's an anecdote. So this wasn't a study, I don't think. But you mentioned a person who said to you that when she leaves a Whole Foods and sees a Salvation Army volunteer, you know, asking for donations, she feels annoyed by that person. But when she leaves a Walmart and sees that person, she's happy to give to them. Tell me about how that sort of matches in your virtue and vice balancing thing.
Yeah, so that's an anecdote which explains other research, in fact, which has found that when people shop in environments which are highly promoting of organic products and where a lot of labeling has sort of this imbued moral superiority, like Purity Tea and, you know, all these other brandings which actually make people feel that they're morally superior, that after they have done the morally superior thing of purchasing said products, that they then are in fact less kind to other people, they're less generous, they're more likely to engage in immoral acts like being deceitful, lying, stealing, not, you know, robbing a bank or anything like that. But one study, for instance, looked being a jerk, but also even more immoral than that. So one study, for instance, looked at people who were shopping in virtual marketplaces, and one was a conventional virtual store and the other was a organic virtual store, and that after people who had been online shopping in the organic virtual store later played an online game where there was opportunity potentially for stealing or lying to your opponent, they were much more likely to engage in that kind of deceitful behavior than the people who'd been shopping in the conventional store, where there was, they were matched products. It would be like Pringles versus, you know, organic something or other potato chips. So the point is that this language actually makes us feel morally superior. And when we think we are morally superior, we tend to behave badly. So this is based on other research in morality, which has shown things like if you give somebody an antiseptic wipe after they've reported, you know, something that they did in their past, like, you know, admit to a time that they were lying on something, and then you give them an antiseptic wipe, they're much more likely to then do something else immoral than if they told their little past transgression and didn't get to sort of clean their hands in the Lady Macbeth kind of way.
Oh my goodness. That's so wild. Like that metaphor really actually like means something to us psychologically, and then we're like, oh, we're actually clean now and we're going to go do something gnarly again.
Exactly. I mean, it is pretty fascinating that these sort of simple acts, it's sort of this idea behind it is what's called embodied cognition. So we do something physical and it actually affects our state of mind. So we do something like cleaning our hands and we feel morally cleansed and therefore capable of engaging in transgressions again because we've cleared the slate. In fact, we may be even starting at a slightly higher point than having nothing in the past. And similarly, when we're grocery shopping and we purchase things which sort of describe that we are morally superior by the branding and by the products themselves, we often behave in these sort of negative ways. And other research on the same topic found that people just seeing labels like USDA organic on products were more likely than to be harsher in their evaluations of other people and moral transgressions and so forth. So it makes us more judgmental of others as well. So in the case of the anecdote of the grocery shopping, you know, after being in an environment where there's all this moral purity being expounded upon in your groceries, then people are less inclined to be generous as opposed to in an environment where moral purity isn't as sanctified and blared from every speaker.
Wow, this is fascinating. Thank you so much for coming in today, Dr. Herz.
Thank you, Francis. It was great to be on.
Rachel Herz teaches at Brown University and Boston College and is the author of Why You Eat What You Eat. And that's our show for the week. I guess I'm sorry to leave you with a little bit of a curveball. It's like a cliffhanger. Like, who can we trust if we can't trust ourselves? But I guess it's a sign that when you dig into how food and culture work together, it's pretty much always going to be more complicated than we realize. And that just means that digging only gets more and more interesting, and that we're all just still processing. And if there's anything you heard today that you'd like more information on, you can always come to our website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, you can register for our monthly giveaway, rifle through our recipes, take a look at our videos, and sign up for our email newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen, and it's all about eating well Monday to Friday. If you don't subscribe to our podcast, please do. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.